carried a famous name, was young and energetic, and might be used to muster those still faithful to the stricken Woodrow Wilson. He was nominated by acclamation. Though his party had little hope of victory, Roosevelt had everything to gain and nothing to lose in terms of his own future prospects. As the vice presidential candidate, he would not be blamed for defeat. By campaigning day after day with unflagging energy and exuberance for his party, however, he could build an account of goodwill that could be drawn upon in the future. Franklin gave everything he had to the campaign. Traveling by train to nearly 40 states, he worked 18 hours a day.
"We really had trouble holding Franklin down on that trip," Lewis Howe recalled. "His enthusiasm was so great, we were after him constantly to keep him from wearing himself down to his bones."
Refusing to listen, he insisted on speaking wherever the train paused, explaining to Howe that if he were elected someday, these people would be his bosses, and they've got a right to know what they're hiring. A reporter on the train with Franklin marveled that once he met a man along the road who wielded any political influence whatever, he never forgot him. Nor did he forget the particular circumstances of the man's connection with the party. In the course of delivering nearly 800 speeches, he polished the ease of his delivery, speaking so simply and directly, one reporter noted, that he managed to keep the driest subjects from seeming heavy. No longer did Eleanor watch with dread when he hesitated, fearing that he might never continue. "On the contrary," she told Sarah, "it is becoming almost impossible to stop F now when he begins to speak. 10 minutes is always 20. 30 is always 45. And the evening speeches are now about 2 hours. Members of his staff all get out and wave at him in front. And when nothing succeeds, I yank his coattails." Inexperience, hubris, weariness, and a penchant for improvisation led inevitably to mistakes along the campaign trail. In Montana, talking about Latin America, he boasted that as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he had something to do with running a couple of little republics. "The facts are that I wrote Haiti's constitution myself, and if I do say, I think it a pretty good constitution." Not only was this a gross exaggeration, but it gave Warren Harding, the Republican presidential candidate, ammunition for a blistering counterattack. The story faded quickly, however, providing but a small dent in an otherwise splendid campaign. Franklin Roosevelt had emerged a national figure. Prepared from the start for defeat, Roosevelt was not in the least depressed when the Democrats lost by an overwhelming majority. "A darn good sale," he characterized the abysmal loss. "Curiously enough," he told a friend, "I do not feel in the least downhearted. It seems to me that everything possible was done during the campaign." Of all the strengths Roosevelt displayed during the campaign, none was of greater significance than his ability to assemble and sustain a remarkably talented and staunchly loyal team that would remain together in the years ahead. For his advance man, he selected Stephen Early, a young wire service reporter who had become his White House press secretary. As his speechwriter, he chose another newsman, Marvin McIntyre, who had become his appointment secretary in the White House. To head his New York office, he hired Charles McCarthy, the veteran bureaucrat who had helped him negotiate the intricacies of the naval bureaucracy, and who would eventually serve in the Justice Department during his presidency. And, of course, there was Lewis Howe, the indispensable figure who would remain by Roosevelt's side until he died. Such was the atmosphere on the long train rides that storytelling, cards, and drinks regularly alleviated the pressure of preparing itineraries, studying local issues, and drafting speeches.
Roosevelt long treasured recollections of the train trip. A fraternity in spirit. To each of these men, Roosevelt presented a pair of gold Tiffany cufflinks with FDR engraved on one side and the recipient's name on the other, binding them together in what became known as the Cufflinks Club, an extended family that expanded over the years to include Missy LaHand, his private secretary, Eleanor Roosevelt, Harry Hopkins, the head of the New Deal Relief Program, and Sam Rosenman, his counsel and chief speechwriter. That Franklin Roosevelt had the weight and breadth to lead the nation was already established to all the members of this original team. They were not simply devoted to him. After months of intimate contact, they had come to revere and love him. No one identified Franklin Roosevelt as a potential president earlier and with more certainty than Lewis Howe, one of the few people who always called him Franklin. At that very first meeting, Howe told a reporter, "I made up my mind that he was presidential timber, and that nothing but an accident could keep him from being president of the United States."
Chapter 4. Lyndon. A steam engine in pants. Lyndon Johnson was a gangly 22-year-old college senior in July 1930 when he delivered his first political speech on behalf of former Governor Pat Neff, who was running for railroad commissioner, a performance that would set in motion a mysterious chain of events that would eventually lead him to the height of power in Washington, D.C. His speech concluded the annual picnic outside the small community of Henley. This picnic was a signal event in South Central Texas and one Lyndon had attended with his father, Sam Johnson, since he was 10 years old. All the candidates for state and local offices were generally present at the day-long speaking. As hundreds of citizens milled about enjoying the barbecue and the outdoor festivities, the candidates were summoned one by one to the makeshift speaker stand to make the case for their election. A similar brand of humor and bombast, of folkloric shrewdness and local pride, might have been heard a century earlier at the Van Dues, where Abraham Lincoln and his fellow aspirants spoke before gatherings of farmers who had come into the village square to auction off their stock, gossip, and especially talk politics. At dusk, the master of ceremonies called Pat Neff's name. When no one responded, he called again to see if someone wanted to speak for him. Still, no one stepped forward. State Representative Welly Hopkins remembered vividly what happened next. The master of ceremonies was about to declare a default when suddenly, "I saw coming through the crowd a young fellow kind of waving his arms about, calling out, 'By God, I'll make a speech for Pat Neff.'" As the tall young man with black curly hair was hoisted upon the tailgate of the wagon bed, which served as a speaker's platform, he was introduced as Sam Johnson's son. Sam had served in the state legislature for 8 years and was widely known and well-liked in the region. Lyndon's speech, according to Hopkins, was a 10-minute, stem-winding, arm-swinging talk on behalf of Pat Neff. "I'm a prairie dog lawyer from Johnson City, Texas," Lyndon began. By identifying himself as a prairie dog lawyer, he employed a vernacular perfectly tailored to his audience. Prairie dog lawyers had little training in the law. They relied upon passionate advocacy rather than legal precedent to defend their clients before a jury. So young Lyndon, with a self-mocking yet assertive tone, let the picnickers know that while he was not an experienced politician, he intended to throw himself into the task of representing the missing Pat Neff. His style of speaking was so wrapped up in youthful enthusiasm and sincerity of purpose, Hopkins recalled, that his audience came along with him. While it wasn't a rich oratorical style, there was a timbre in his voice that was pleasantly received. When he finished his testimony for Neff, The crowd responded with whistles and sustained applause. Indeed, his speech was considered the hit of the Henley picnic. From the time Lyndon was a small boy, he identified with his father's political ambitions. In the evenings, when Sam sat in the brown rocker on the porch, swapping tales and jokes with three or four political cronies, the boy stood in the half-darkness of the doorway, straining to overhear the comings and goings of people in the legislature. He liked the animated, crude way the men spoke, the deep knowledge they had of the different families in their region. "I loved going with my father to the legislature," Johnson remembered. "I would sit in the gallery for hours watching all the activity on the floor and then would wander around the halls trying to figure out what was going on." Sam Johnson was a popular figure in the State House. "If you can't come into a room full of people and tell right away who is for you and who is against you, you have no business in politics," he told his son. Sam was very friendly, one colleague recalled, a very down-to-earth man, a man who attracted people and knew how to deal with people. He was known to have an explosive temper, but it was like a sunshine thing, a neighbor recalled. It was gone in a minute, and then he was always going about doing something nice. He was a progressive Democrat, speaking up for the people against the interests, supporting bills to establish an 8-hour workday, regulate public utility companies, and tax corporations. He championed the underdog, using his office to help poor farmers, army veterans, and soldiers' widows. "We got to look after these people," Sam told a friend. "That's what we're here for." Lyndon was his father's shadow and replica. They shared the same long arms, large nose, enormous ears, and hard squint. Lyndon learned to envelop people in the same fashion. "They walked the same, had the same nervous mannerisms," recalled Wright Patman, who served with Sam in the state legislature and later became a congressman. "And Lyndon clutched you like his daddy did when he talked to you." And like his father, gregarious young Lyndon struck up conversations with everyone he met. He became a favorite of all the older women in town, inquiring how they were feeling, how things were going. If he heard a group of men talking politics on the street, he would stand on the sidelines, smitten. At 10, he took a job after school shining shoes at Cecil Maddox Barbershop, the place where politics and the latest items of news were discussed. The only thing Lyndon loved more than accompanying his father to the State House was traveling along with him on the campaign trail. "We drove in the Model T Ford from farm to farm up and down the valley, stopping at every door. My father would do most of the talking. He would bring the neighbors up to date on local gossip, talk about the crops and about the bills he'd introduced in the legislature, and always he'd bring along an enormous crust of homemade bread and a large jar of homemade jam. When we got tired or hungry, we'd stop by the side of the road. He sliced the bread, smeared it with jam, and split the slices with me. I'd never seen him happier. Families all along the way opened up their homes to us. If it was hot outside, we were invited in for big servings of homemade ice cream. If it was cold, we were given hot tea. Christ, sometimes I wished it could go on forever." This campaign idol offered a welcome, albeit temporary, relief for both father and son from the discord of the Johnson family household, a place often filled with severe tensions that contributed to Lyndon's excitable temperament. All his life he would vacillate between security and insecurity, assertiveness and obsequiousness, charm and taunting cruelty, a desire to please and a need for control. In contrast to the balanced, secure, and placid childhood upon which Franklin Roosevelt's genuinely confident and optimistic nature was anchored, Lyndon had to negotiate between his father and mother, each representing very different and clashing worlds of values. My mother told me the first year of her marriage was the worst year of her life, Johnson remembered. Having grown up in a two-story rock house with a fruitful orchard of perfectly spaced trees, terraced flower beds, broad walks, and a white picket fence, she was utterly unprepared for the disorder and isolation of Sam Johnson's small cabin on a muddy stream with neither electricity nor indoor plumbing. The daughter of a college-educated lawyer and herself a graduate of Baylor University at a time when few women attended college, Rebecca Baines had aspired to be a writer when she interviewed the dashing and dynamic Sam Johnson for her family newspaper during his first term in the state legislature. A whirlwind courtship ensued, leading to marriage and the problem of adjustment to a completely opposite personality, as well as a strange and new way of life. Accustomed to culture, books, and intellectual discussions about philosophy and literature, Rebecca found that the man she had fallen in love with enjoyed nothing more than sitting up half the night with his political cronies, drinking beer, sharing gossip, swapping stories. She had originally hoped that Sam would run for national office and carry her away to the nation's capital, where ideas and ideals would be discussed. But he soon made it clear that he had no interest in leaving home. Meanwhile, her own days and nights were consumed in the tedium of drawing water from the well, feeding chickens, boiling clothes, and scrubbing floors on her hands and knees, leaving insufficient time for the unread books piled high in her bedroom, and no time at all for writing. She was miserable. "Then I came along," Lyndon said, "and suddenly everything was all right again. I could do all the things she never did." Lyndon seemed at first the perfect instrument for Rebecca to realize her ambitions. Relatives and friends claimed they had never seen such a friendly baby, nor one as inquisitive and intelligent. He learned the alphabet before he was 2, learned to read and spell before he was 4, and at 3 could recite long passages from Longfellow and Tennyson. "I'll never forget how much my mother loved me when I recited those poems," Johnson said. "The minute I finished, she'd take me in her arms and hug me so hard, I sometimes thought I'd be strangled to death." Even after she gave birth to 4 other children, Lyndon remained Rebecca's favorite. "I remember playing games with her that only the 2 of us could play, and she would always let me win, even if, to do so, we had to change the rules. I knew how much she needed me. I liked that. Made me feel big and important. Made me feel I could do anything in the world." But opposite the bright and beaming side of the moon was an equally dark side, an insecurity that would plague Lyndon Johnson for the rest of his life. When he failed to fulfill his mother's ambitions for him, when he became a sluggish student or resisted continuing violin and dancing lessons, she withdrew her love and affection. "For days after I quit those lessons, she walked around the house pretending I was dead," Johnson glumly said. "And then," he added, "I had to watch her being especially warm and nice to my father and sisters." Love was alternately lavished and snatched away, a quid pro quo for obedience and achievement. In later years, Johnson would exhibit a similar pattern in dealing with friends, colleagues, and members of his staff. He would blanket someone with generosity, care, and affection, but in recompense expect total loyalty and sterling achievement. Failing this standard was perceived by him as a betrayal. His affection would be withdrawn, a pattern of behavior so pronounced it earned the epithet the Johnson freeze-out. Storytelling played a central role in young Lyndon's life, just as it had in the lives of young Abraham, Theodore, and Franklin. When tensions in the Johnson household flared, Lyndon found the perfect escape down the road at his grandfather's house. There, the two of them could share an hour or more while Sam Ely Sr. elaborated upon his cowboy days, driving a herd of 1,500 cattle from ranches in Texas up the Chisholm Trail to Abilene, Kansas. "I sat beside the rocker on the floor of the porch," Johnson recollected, "thinking all the while how lucky I was to have as a granddaddy this big man with the white beard who had lived the most exciting life imaginable." Sam Sr. possessed a narrative gift able to shape those early adventures into a vast trove of seminal tales that would form the building blocks of Lyndon's heroic conception of leadership. Central to such stories was the image of the lead cowboy driving cattle through icy rivers, ever vigilant to avoid the ultimate horror of the stampede. Lyndon's idealization of the bold cowboy and his beloved grandfather's cattle-driving tales shaped his concept of manhood. Just as the perilous tales of hunters and deer-slayers living on the margins of wilderness informed Theodore Roosevelt's ideal of the heroic male, the extravagant oral tradition of the Old West infused Johnson's language. Only Abraham Lincoln, who had actually endured physical danger and the bitter hardships of wilderness life, never romanticized his family's past. Lyndon's classmates recognized the superiority of his intelligence. "He was very brilliant," one schoolmate recalled. The boys his age were simply not in his class mentally. Even the older boys saw that he talked and thought faster than they did. He was too restless to sit still or concentrate in class, however, and recoiled from completing his homework. His mother tried to remedy his lack of preparation by reading his assignments out loud while he ate breakfast, but he felt smothered by her force feedings. Consequently, he was held back and forced to complete a summer session before graduating high school. Nor, despite his mother's best urgings, did he ever become a reader. "Is it true?" he would ask her when she handed him a book, agreeing to open its cover only if it were about history or government. If Abraham Lincoln carried away from his standing at the top of his class the self-confidence of a man who has never met his intellectual equal, Lyndon Johnson remained forever plagued by a sense of academic inferiority. "My daddy always told me that if I brushed up against the grindstone of life, I'd come away with more polish than I could ever get at Harvard or Yale," he said years later, a wistful tone in his voice. "I wanted to believe him, but somehow I never could." The way you get ahead in the world, you get close to those that are the heads of things, Lyndon told his college roommate when he finally arrived at Southwest Texas State Teachers College in San Marcos. "Like President Evans, for example." Cecil Evans had served as the college president for 15 years and was well respected by faculty and students alike. Aware of the demands on the president's time, Johnson concluded, "There is only one way to get to know Evans, and that was to work for him, directly." It was school policy to give students part-time jobs in the library, cafeteria, bookstore, administrative offices, or maintenance department. Lyndon's first job was on the janitorial crew, picking up papers and trash. Most students did the minimum work necessary to keep their jobs, but Lyndon labored with extravagant enthusiasm, making a game of collecting the largest trash pile in the shortest time. His eagerness garnered a promotion to the janitorial crew that worked inside the administration building. Assigned to mop floors, Lyndon focused on the hallway outside the president's office, allowing him to strike up conversations as President Evans passed by. Like Lyndon, Evans was enamored of politics from his earliest days. In fact, Evans still harbored the hope that someday he might run for office. With Lyndon, as with no other student or even most faculty members, He could enjoy conversations about doings in the legislature or share stories about various political figures. When Lyndon asked if he could work in his office running errands and delivering messages, Evans promptly agreed. What began as an inconsequential position soon became, in Lyndon's hands, a generator of actual power as he expanded the limited function of messenger by encouraging recipients to transmit their own communications through him. Occupying a desk in the president's foyer, he would announce the arrival of visitors as if he were the appointment secretary rather than the office messenger. In time, the faculty members and administrative officials, whose names Lyndon always remembered, came to think of the skinny young Texan with black curly hair as a direct channel to the president. Increasingly impressed by Lyndon's perceptive observations about state politics, Evans brought him to Austin when committee hearings were held on appropriations for state colleges and other educational matters. Soon he began relying on his young messenger to work up reports on the hearings, which Lyndon did with flair, analyzing the inclinations of individual legislators as well as the mood and atmosphere of the legislature as a whole. Before long, Lyndon was handling the president's political correspondence, drafting reports for various state agencies, and taking up residence in a room above the garage in the president's house. In time, he almost seemed the son President Evans never had, a son who not only provided affection and companionship, but whose organizational skills and attention to detail allowed him to assume burdensome tasks and responsibilities belonging to the older man. Without a doubt, many students perceived Lyndon's flagrant consolidation of power as repellent. They considered his ingratiating attitude toward administrators and faculty kowtowing, suck-assing, brown-nosing. Several of Lyndon's classmates regarded him as ruthless, prepared to cut your throat to get what he wanted. "They didn't just dislike Lyndon Johnson," one said. "They despised him." "Ambition is an uncomfortable companion," Lyndon conceded in a college editorial. "He creates a discontent with present surroundings and achievements. He is never satisfied, but always pressing forward." This personification of ambition lacks comprehension of the impression he made on others. He failed to understand when to ease up and was often blind to the collateral cost of his own compulsive energies. Lyndon's need to achieve this self-aggrandizing and self-serving ambition was harnessed in the service of a larger purpose for the first time when, during a year-long break from college, he became the principal of a 6-teacher Mexican-American elementary school in Cotulla, Texas, a dusty, impoverished town not too far from the border with Mexico. Most of the families lived in dirt hovels, engaged in a continual struggle to wring a living from the dry and treeless land. As principal, Lyndon occupied his first true position of authority and employed every leadership attribute he already possessed. Indefatigable energy, ability to persuade, willingness to fight for what he wanted, intuition, enterprise, and initiative to enlarge opportunities for his students and to improve their lives. The students adored him, his fellow teachers came to admire him, and he left an enduring impression upon the little community as a whole. At last, biographer Robert Caro observes, Lyndon was the somebody he had always wanted to be. He was neither trying to absorb power by accommodating an older mentor, nor savagely competing with peers. He was simply trying to elevate the hopes and conditions of the marginalized and dispossessed of this South Texas town. Empathy fired Lyndon's efforts at Cotulla. "My students were poor, and they often came to class without breakfast, hungry," Johnson later recalled. "And they knew, even in their youth, the pain of prejudice." Because there was no school funding for extracurricular activities, he used half his first month's salary to buy sports equipment, and then badgered the school board to include track and field events, baseball games, and volleyball matches in the school budget. In addition to his administrative responsibilities as principal, this one-man band taught 5th, 6th, and 7th grade classes, coached debating, and served as the softball coach, the drama coach, and the choir leader. At first, he had the children practice and compete against one another. Soon, however, he arranged field days with a dozen other regional schools. A chorus of voices decades later testifies to the enormous impact Lyndon left on the school. "He respected the kids more than any other teacher we ever had," said Manuel Sanchez. "He put us to work," another student remembered. "But he was the kind of teacher you wanted to work for. You felt an obligation to him and to yourself to do your work." "He was strict," they all agreed. "He made them stay after school if they hadn't done their homework. But he was down to earth and friendly, and years later, they were grateful so much had been demanded of them." And no one worked more fiercely than Lyndon Johnson. The first to arrive in the morning and the last to leave at night. "He didn't give himself what we call spare time," a fellow teacher said. "He walked so fast it was like seeing a blur," one townsman recalled. His unflagging energy, his ferocious ambition, and his compulsive drive to organize were now linked to something larger than himself. The success he sought was coupled with an equally powerful desire to transform the lives of his students. "I was determined to spark something inside them, to fill their souls with ambition and interest and belief in the future. I was determined to give them what they needed to make it in this world, to help them finish their education. Then the rest would take care of itself." The year Johnson spent teaching the Mexican-American children in Cotulla was a pivotal experience, one to which Johnson returned again and again. "I can still see the faces of the children who sat in my class," he said years later. This was the display of a different kind of leadership, one based on empathy and generosity he had never exercised before. Among the seasoned political eyes trained upon young Lyndon Johnson on the occasion of his first political speech at the Henley Picnic of 1930 was the gaze of Welly Hopkins, who was about to launch a campaign for the state Senate. On the spur of the moment that day, Hopkins had cannily invited Lyndon to take a leading position in his campaign, a chance encounter that would have a far-reaching impact on Lyndon's future. Even in that day, Hopkins recalled of young Lyndon, "Politics was in his blood, just by inheritance and by training and by general aptitude. Not only was he steeped in political lore, but he was gifted with a very unusual ability to meet and greet the public and to organize." Within days, Lyndon had mobilized a half dozen of his college friends into a tightly knit machine. "We worked Blanco County in and out," Hopkins recalled of his travels with Lyndon. "I was up every branch of the Pedernales, following Lyndon's judgment almost completely, because he knew the area so well and had a favorable standing with the local people." No matter how tired they were, Lyndon scoured the countryside for votes, even if the car had to travel to a single farm at the end of an unpaved road. On one occasion, Hopkins laughingly recalled, Lyndon had him stand in a dry creek bed to deliver a 10-minute speech to a group of three, a man, his wife, and a relative. Such attention to detail paid off. Hopkins secured a surprising victory. "I always felt he was the real balance of the difference as to whether I'd be elected," a grateful Hopkins said. Word spread that there was a wonder kid in San Marcos who knew more about politics than anyone in the area. Lyndon was poised for entry into a political career, but the Times said otherwise. The Depression offered no opportunity for a government job. Fortunately, his uncle George Johnson, longtime head of the history department at Sam Houston High, found him a position as a teacher of public speaking and debate. The moment Lyndon arrived at Sam Houston High, he set a dramatic goal for the debate team. Though they had never won anything in competition with neighboring schools, Lyndon told them that for the first time in the history of the school, the team would win not only the city and district competitions, but would go on to the state championship. Straight away, he had set a psychological target to elevate the team's ambitions before the debating season even got underway. At Houston High, as at Cotulla, Lyndon channeled his ravenous drive for success to benefit others, deploying his headlong leadership style to mobilize funding for the debate club. Luther Jones, one of the club members, recalled overhearing a rather vigorous argument Johnson had with the principal, who told him that money for the debating team had never been part of the school budget. "Yes, but you never had a teacher like me," Johnson countered. "By some people's standards," Jones observed, "you would say he was very conceited, and surely his attitude was extremely aggressive, but he could get people to do things they would, under ordinary circumstances, never think of doing." Lyndon appeared to his students a human dynamo, a steam engine in pants, driven by a work ethic and an unlimited enthusiasm that proved contagious. His first day on the job, he had students stand before their mates and make animal noises, anything to slough off nervousness and self-consciousness. "He had a variety of ways to get you going," debate club member Gene Latimer recalled. "He'd either make you feel ashamed that you hadn't seemed to invest sufficient time in the library studying the topic at hand, or he'd brag on you and make you want to go do some more. And always, he liked to pit one against the other." These techniques came to him instinctively, Latimer believed. "No one before or since has ever motivated me like he could. If he told any of us to go get up on a roof of a building and jump off, we'd all pile up there and do it." Storytelling, Johnson taught his students, was the key to successful debating, in contrast to the previous public speaking teacher who came from the old school and trained his debaters to be bombastic and loud. Lyndon urged a conversational style that illustrated points with concrete stories. "Act like you're talking to those folks," he counseled his students. "Look one of them in the eye and then move on and look another one in the eye." During competitions, he utilized all his supple array of gestures and facial expressions to cue and prompt, now frowning, narrowing his eyes, creasing his brow, shaking his head, gaping in wonder, creating a silent movie to steer and goad his charges to victory. From the start, Johnson sought to create an aura around the debate club that had previously been reserved for the football team. At the first competition, only 7 people attended, but as the undefeated team's victory tally mounted, excitement began to build. By the time the team clinched the city championship and began competing at the district level, every seat in the auditorium was taken. He had transformed debate into a community-wide campaign complete with pep rallies, cheerleaders, and team sweaters. Indeed, an amalgam of his father's coarse politicking and his mother's prim scrutiny of appearance and demeanor when she taught elocution at Johnson City High can be clearly traced in their son's pedagogy. When the team clinched the district-level championship, pictures of the 2-star debaters Gene Latimer and Luther Jones were splashed across city newspapers. Though the state championship was lost in the final competition by a single vote, by the time the school year ended, Latimer proudly noted, "We were more important than the football team." The services Lyndon rendered to Welly Hopkins' campaign were remembered and repaid with Welly's recommendation to Richard Clayburgh, who had just won an election to fill a vacancy in the 14th Congressional District, that Lyndon Johnson was just the man he needed as his legislative secretary, in essence his chief of staff. After meeting Lyndon, Clayburgh promptly offered the job. A few days later, the two men set off on a Pullman train for the 2-day trip to Washington. "All that day I'd gone about feeling excited, nervous, and sad," Johnson recalled. "I was about to leave home to meet the adventure of my future. I felt grown up, but my mind kept ranging backward in time. I saw myself as a boy skipping down the road to my granddaddy's house. I remembered the many nights I had stood in the doorway listening to my father's political talk. I remembered the evenings with my mother when my daddy was away. Now, all that was behind me. If ever a destination seemed a destiny for Lyndon Johnson, it was Washington, D.C., a city whose intricacies he would master and for a while dominate as completely as he had dominated his college in San Marcos, Cotulla, and Houston High. Upon seeing the Capitol Dome for the first time, Johnson vowed that someday he would become a congressman in his own right. "I would not say I was without ambition ever," he recalled. "It was very exciting to me to realize that the people, many of them that you were passing, were probably congressmen, at least, maybe senators, members of the cabinet. And there was the smell of power. It's got an odor, you know. Power, I mean." Such was the nature of Johnson's driven temperament that he had no sooner settled into the Dodge Hotel, where the majority of congressional secretaries lived, than he began his quest to determine the sources and relationships of power in the nation's capital. There was no time to waste. The scale of inquiry was so much greater than ever before. His adaptation of rural friendliness to his competitive city lodgings made for bizarrely comic tactics. He took 4 separate showers in the shared bathroom his first night to engage as many people as possible. The next morning, he brushed his teeth every 10 minutes, all to winnow out the most useful informants in the lot. "This skinny boy was as green as anybody could be," an older congressional secretary said. But within a few months, he knew how to operate in Washington better than some who had been here 20 years. Managing a staff for the first time, Johnson filled his 2 positions with young men whose work ethic he had already formed and tested, his star debaters from Houston High, Latimer and Jones. "Johnson was a hard man to work for because he insisted on perfection," Jones recalled. "The chief, as he was known to them, wanted to answer every day's mail every day, and every letter had to be just right, which meant typing and retyping the same letter over and over again until it was exactly the way he wanted it." One Saturday evening, Johnson came back to work after dinner to find Latimer and Jones gone. A note on the desk said they had gone to a movie and would be back at 9. Shuffling through the mail stack, he spied what he was searching for, an unanswered constituent letter. Seizing it, he raced to the local theater, found the 2 men, and brought them outside, only to learn that in compliance to his earlier directive, the letter in question had been put aside. Anxious to mollify matters, Johnson invited them to dinner at a local restaurant. No sooner had the first drink arrived than up he jumped. "We've been relaxing long enough," he said. "There's still 3 more good working hours until we fold." When critics wrote about Johnson's ruthless manner in dealing with the members of his staff, Latimer insisted that his boss was extremely sentimental about the people close to him. And yet increasingly the price for admission into his select extended family had grown from dedication and unquestioned loyalty to devouring all of the subordinates' personal time and space. "If he caught you reading a letter from your mother," Jones said, "or if you were taking a crap, he'd say, 'Son, can't you please try a little harder to do that on your own time?'" Within a matter of months, Clayburgh's office had developed a reputation as one of the most efficient on Capitol Hill. For Congressman Clayburgh, a bluff and good-natured multimillionaire, the situation was ideal. Preferring to spend his time playing golf, poker, or polo, he was happy to let Lyndon run the show. And Lyndon, in turn, was delighted with the vacuum Clayburgh afforded him. From the start, Johnson gave first priority to constituent requests, understanding the central importance of strengthening Clayburgh's elected base at home. Through prompt and helpful answers to the hundreds of petitioners who wrote each month, veterans with claim of injuries sustained during World War I, desperate farmers hoping for aid from the Agricultural Administration, unemployed men and women in need of a government job, word of Clayburgh's reflected zeal began to spread across the district. On the inside, Lyndon's reputation as a doer was established. Since most of the constituent casework involved problems with one bureaucracy or another, Johnson had to spend hours each day penetrating the bureaucratic maze, figuring out where the power lay, identifying and targeting the person who would make the ultimate decision. Then his bombardment commenced, hectoring pressure combined with contagious enthusiasm, flattery mingled with threat, until the determination he sought was finally made. He believed that every problem had a solution, Jones marveled. He refused to take no for an answer, and when the constituent received what he was hoping for, Johnson was jubilant, treating each successful case as a major victory for the team. With stunning audacity and speed, Lyndon Johnson had become a congressman in all but name. By the age of 25, Lyndon Johnson was on the path to a political career. He had come a long way in the 3 short years since that moment at the Henley picnic when he raced through the crowd to deliver his first political speech. Earlier than the 3 men we have studied, he had laid out an elaborate blueprint for a different kind of leadership, an executive competence, and a distinctive grinding pattern of behavior that would mark his management style the rest of his days. Already he had become a consummate political animal, a man with a dowsing rod inexorably drawn to every reservoir of power. The instinctive ability to locate the gears and levers of power in any institution, to secure wise and faithful mentors, and to transform minor positions into substantial founts of influence would accompany every stage of his upward climb. In contrast to Abraham Lincoln, who was able to relax with poetry and drama, or Theodore Roosevelt, who was interested in birds, the mating habits of wolves, and the latest novels, or Franklin Roosevelt, who spent happy hours sailing, playing with his stamps, enjoying poker, and genial social chatter, Lyndon Johnson could never unwind. Luther Jones never remembered him reading a novel, or indeed reading anything other than the newspapers and current magazines he obsessively devoured. He rarely went to movies or plays, for he disliked sitting in the dark for 3 hours, unable to talk. At baseball games, he would insist on talking politics between innings and even between pitches. At social events, he danced with the wives of congressmen and government officials, rather than with single girls, discussing the latest news and political gossip as they twirled across the floor. All his life, he would continue to work at the same compulsive pace, as if victory and success might somehow reclaim the steady love and affection he had been denied as a child. The same qualities Lyndon brought to every stage of his climb, single-minded determination, contagious enthusiasm, flattery mingled with threats, indefatigable energy, and an overwhelming personality, were conspicuous in his successful endeavor to win the hand of Claudia Lady Bird Taylor in marriage. If Theodore Roosevelt waged a concerted year-long campaign to woo his wife and her family, Lyndon, with not a second to spare, accelerated the process, reaching his goal in a matter of weeks. The daughter of a wealthy businessman, Lady Bird had recently graduated from the University of Texas with a degree in journalism. After a single date in Austin, Johnson, to his credit and good fortune, decided not to let this intelligent, reserved, sensitive, and shrewd woman go. During their first conversation, she later remembered, he told her all manner of extraordinarily direct things about himself, his salary as a secretary to a congressman, his ambitions, even about all the members of his family and how much insurance he carried. It was as if he wanted to give a complete picture of his life and of his capabilities. She thought he was very, very good-looking, with lots of black, wavy hair, but considered it sheer lunacy when on their second date he asked her to marry him. "I'm ambitious, proud, energetic, and madly in love with you," he declared. "I see something I know I want. I immediately exert efforts to get it." On his next visit to Austin 2 months later, he issued an ultimatum. "We either get married now or we never will." When she agreed, he released a Texas yip and then drove straight to San Antonio, where they were married in a simple ceremony that same day. "I don't think Lady Bird ever had a chance once he set eyes on her," Latimer observed 3 decades later. "She was his balancing wheel," Jones said. "He was constitutionally impatient. She was constitutionally calm. He was abrupt and profane. She was gentle and gracious. Without such forbearance and devotion, without a love steadily given and never withdrawn, the course of Lyndon Johnson's ascent amid the most complicated intrigues of the political world becomes inconceivable." Furthermore, the home Lady Bird established in Washington proved instrumental not only to Lyndon's stability, but to his enlarging ambitions. Lady Bird offered a welcoming hospitality to Lyndon's guests at any time of day or night. He might call her as late as 6 or 7 to say he was bringing home a half dozen people, and by the time they arrived, the table would be set, drinks ready, the supper cooking. Among the many guests, none played a larger role in Lyndon's future than Sam Rayburn, the Democratic congressman from Bonham, Texas, who had served with Lyndon's father in the state legislature and would go on to become Speaker of the House for 17 years. Without a wife or family of his own, Mr. Sam was often lonely in the hours when the House was not in session. Sensing this, Lyndon more and more frequently began inviting him for dinner, invitations that soon extended to breakfasts on weekends so the two men could read the Sunday papers together. The warmth and informality of the atmosphere engendered a genuine companionship, providing Lyndon with a wise, trusted, and most useful mentor, and Mr. Sam with the affectionate and loyal son he never had. And soon, Mr. Sam's exercise of brute political force would prove indispensable to Lyndon's attainment of the next way station of his political rise. On a Tuesday morning in June 1935, by executive order, President Franklin Roosevelt created the National Youth Administration. The NYA was designed to save a lost generation of young people by providing part-time work for students from needy families who could not otherwise afford to stay in school, as well as full-time jobs for thousands of unemployed youths between the ages of 16 and 21. That very Tuesday, Lyndon approached Mr. Sam and proposed himself as the perfect candidate for director of the Texas NYA. Straight away, Rayburn asked an uncharacteristic favor of Texas Senator Tom Connally. "He wanted me to ask President Roosevelt to appoint Lyndon Johnson," Connally recalled. Sam was agitated. That this was a matter of significant personal import for Rayburn was so apparent and persuasive that Connally agreed at once. Connally was unable to convince Roosevelt, however, that the 26-year-old Lyndon, with no administrative experience, was qualified to run a statewide agency. In truth, the largest staff Lyndon had ever managed consisted of 3 people. Furthermore, another man had been announced for the post before Rayburn appealed to the president. Nonetheless, Roosevelt heeded Rayburn's wish. In short order, the White House acknowledged that a mistake had been made. The post would go instead to Clayburgh's congressional secretary, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Concerns about Johnson's youth and inexperience were soon put to rest as it became increasingly clear that the youngest state director in the United States possessed a rare cluster of executive skills. "I'm not the assistant type," he rightly told a friend upon leaving Clayburgh's office. "I'm the executive type." Recruiting a staff that would eventually comprise nearly 50 people posed the first hurdle. He began by summoning the same young men he had teamed with since college at Sam Houston High and in Clayburgh's office. They were familiar with his driving leadership. They had witnessed his modus operandi in smaller arenas, and they were ready for a larger challenge. Most of them were poor, like himself. They, too, had found it necessary to scavenge for jobs in the depressed time in order to stay in college. For them, as for Johnson, the mission of the NYA to provide education, training, and jobs for young people was personal. "We gathered that dream in ourselves and agreed to be a part of it and go to work," one staffer recalled. The enormity of the statewide undertaking overwhelmed Johnson until he came up with an ideal plan to start the ball rolling with an all-important inaugural project. He would put thousands of out-of-school youth to work building roadside parks along state highways where travelers could stop to rest, have something to eat, and go to the bathroom. Within a matter of weeks, Washington approved the paperwork and the plan was put into operation. While the NYA paid for the labor, the State Highway Department provided the supervision, the trucks, and the material. State engineers trained the young men to mix concrete, build driveways off the roads into the parks, lay bricks for barbecue pits, construct picnic tables and benches, plant shade trees, and curbside shrubs. Johnson was beside himself with happiness when the first project was up and running, for he knew that it would create an atmosphere of success. When the roadside parks project proved successful, he made sure it was publicized throughout Texas, and in a short time it actually became a model for the nation. Lyndon's performance during this first undertaking opened the door to supplementary funding and scores of additional projects. Within 6 months, Johnson had convinced officials in 350 agencies, schools, hospitals, libraries, recreational facilities, to provide the material and supervision for their particular project. 18,000 young people were at work repairing school buses, surveying land and building arbors, swimming pools, school gyms, and basketball courts. It was as if the recreational and extracurricular projects he had once furnished out of his own pocket for recess and after-school activities at Cotulla could now be expanded with federal monies across all of Texas. When Eleanor Roosevelt came to Texas in 1936, she asked to meet the youthful state director about whom she'd heard so much. As the pressure increased, however, accounts of the chief's frantic, harsh, even abusive behavior toward his staff multiplied. "Everything had to be done now," one staffer recalled, "and he could get very angry if something couldn't be done immediately." Seconds after dictating a letter, he couldn't wait to see the finished product. "Where's that letter?" he would shout to his secretary. If his howl didn't produce the desired result, he would pull the letter midstream from the typewriter. "The hours were long and hard," recalled Bill Deason, another old friend Johnson had recruited. "The team worked 6 days a week, from 8 a.m. to midnight. Sundays were reserved for staff meetings to go over what had been done and outline plans for the week ahead. The lights and the elevators in the government building were supposed to be turned off at 10 p.m., but Johnson persuaded the building manager to leave them on until midnight, and sometimes 1 a.m., until the building owner intervened. There were no clock watchers on the staff. Indeed, it seemed as if Johnson had simply never heard of a clock. He instilled fear. He kept everyone on edge. "He would pair us off, or there'd be one or two or three of us, and you were always behind somebody else," recalled Ray Roberts, a member of the staff. "He'd go to one person and tell him how great the other was doing, and that he ought to try to catch up. Then the next day, he'd reverse the process. I don't care how hard I worked," one staffer lamented. "I was always behind." Staffers never knew what might trigger an outburst. God, he could rip a man up and down, one humiliated team member remembered. It could be a cluttered desk, which he took as a sign of disorganization, or a clean desk, which signified idleness. More often than not, his blistering outbursts were followed by indulgent affection, tactile sentimentality, effusive praise, or contrition. For some team members, Johnson's oscillating behavior proved too much to bear. A few broke down physically, others quit, but the majority stayed. Why did the team members stay on? Leadership studies suggest such behaviors undermine internal motivation, that pitting workers against one another rarely succeeds in the long run, and that public humiliation crushes an employee's spirit, autonomy, and production. Yet Johnson's team, by and large, performed magnificently. Aubrey Williams, the National NYA director, publicly declared that the NYA program in Texas was paramount in the entire nation. How did the team accomplish so much, so quickly, and for so long? The answers require an appreciation of Johnson's unsurpassed work ethic, the feeling among staff members that they were learning important skills and the sense of shared engagement in a significant mission. No matter how late they stayed, nearly all the staff members agreed. Johnson closed the door behind them. No matter how early they arrived, he was already there. "Now, fellas, we can do this," Johnson exhorted his team. "If you all put your shoulders to the wheel and pitch in." Here, as in Washington, Lady Bird proved an indispensable ally. By making her home an extension of the workplace, she softened the often inconsiderate harshness of Lyndon's compulsive pace. Various staff members lived with the Johnsons in a room on the second floor. They ate breakfast and often dinner at the house. "We weren't like boarders," Bill Deason recalled. "We had the run of the house, and I felt like a member of the family." Mind-numbing meetings going over NYA rules and regulations, paragraph by paragraph, page by page, were often held on the Johnson porch. "This was usually pretty late at night," William Sherman Birdwell recalled. "Lady Bird always had coffee and cake for us." For the young men, Johnson, though hardly older than they, proved an inspiring mentor, motivating them not only to work harder, observed one staffer, but to be more imaginative, to think of new approaches that we could take to stretch the boundaries or the limitations under which we operated, to be more effective. They considered him the greatest organizer they had ever seen. They marveled at his ability to put first things first and more or less take them one at a time. And yet, while focused on the present, he seemed to know what was coming next. They believed he could actually see around corners. Working so closely with the most forceful and unusual leader they had ever met, they felt they were daily learning something new. "And we made no bones about it," Ray Roberts acknowledged. They all knew then, even before Lyndon was 30, that he was going somewhere, and that it would be great to go along with him. More than anything else, however, what allowed the staff to endure Lyndon's overbearing behavior was the sense they were joined together in an incredibly exciting new organization that promised to change the lives of thousands of young people who had lost hope during the early years of the Depression, providing them with jobs, keeping them in school, teaching them marketable skills, renewing their faith in the future. By hitching their lives to Lyndon Johnson, his staffers knew they were riding the momentum, breadth, and meaning of a larger story. The swiftness with which Lyndon Johnson made life-altering decisions was prominently displayed when an opportunity suddenly arose to run for the House of Representatives. On February 23, 1937, not 18 months into his directorship of the Texas NYA, Lyndon was conducting the fellow director of the Kansas NYA on a tour of several of his work projects when his eyes fell on the headline of a newspaper left on a park bench. "Congressman James P. Buchanan of Brenham dies." "I just couldn't keep my mind on my visitor," Johnson later said. "I kept thinking that this was my district and this was my chance. The day seemed endless. She never stopped talking, and I had to pretend total interest in everything we were seeing and doing. There were times when I thought I'd explode from all the excitement bottled up inside." Not 7 weeks later, in a special election conducted against 8 far better known and more experienced opponents, the 29-year-old Lyndon Johnson was elected Buchanan's successor. How was victory accomplished against older, veteran politicians, all prominent, well-established citizens in a district where, at the outset, Lyndon Johnson was hardly known? For a start, Lyndon's almost instantaneous decision to run cleared the most important obstacle to victory. While the other eight candidates put off their decision until Buchanan's widow determined if she would run, Lyndon publicly declared 3 days after the funeral. Buchanan had represented the district for nearly a quarter of a century. It might have been deemed inappropriate to challenge his 57-year-old widow who had publicly hinted that she desired the seat.
"She's an old woman," Sam Johnson shrewdly counseled his son. "She's too old for a fight. She knows she's going to have a fight, she won't run. Announce now, before she announces. If you do, she won't run."
Sam's prediction hit the mark after Lyndon announced she resolved not to run. Lyndon had consulted a very small circle before making his decision. Most important was a man who had become a trusted mentor in Austin, Alvin Wirtz, an influential lawyer and politician who was serving as chair of the advisory board of Texas NYA. Wirtz had a wife and daughter, his secretary Mary Rather said, but he would have loved to have had a son, and he loved him, Lyndon, as a son. When Wirtz told him he would need at least $10,000 to make a run, Lady Bird called her father to ask for the money.
$10,000? Her father asked. Isn't that a great deal? What about $5,000 or $3,000?
No, Bird said. We've been told it must be $10,000.
All right, he replied. $10,000 will be transferred to Lyndon's bank by tomorrow morning.
And Lyndon remembered. I was at the bank at 9 a.m. the next morning, and there it was. As soon as the die was cast, Luther Jones recalled, before he had publicly announced, before he had even sent in his resignation from the NYA, Johnson walked out on the street, and he immediately, first person we passed, stuck his hand out and said, "I'm Lyndon Johnson. I'm running for Congress." I bet he shook hands with 50 people before we got to his car. Johnson read his official announcement from the porch of the Johnson City home. After Lyndon spoke, Sam Johnson, stricken the year before by a massive heart attack, rose to embrace his son. "My father became a young man again," Johnson recalled. "He looked out into all those faces he knew so well, and then he looked at me, and I saw tears in his eyes as he told the crowd how terribly proud he was of me and how much hope he had for our country, if only his son could be up there in the nation's capital with Roosevelt and Rayburn and all those good Democrats. When he finally sat down, they began applauding, and they kept applauding for almost 10 minutes. I looked over at my mother and saw that she, too, was clapping and smiling. It was a proud moment for the Johnson family." Johnson's strategy left the competitive field flat-footed. To stand out from the better-known pack, he presented himself as a total Roosevelt man, trumpeting his support not only for the popular aspects of the New Deal, but for the president's recent